Socrates' Life and Works. Socrates was born in 469 BC in a village on the slopes of Mount Lycabettus, which was then a 20-minute walk from Athens. His father was a sculptor and his mother a midwife. Initially, the young Socrates was apprenticed to his father. According to one tradition, he worked on the three muses in their habits, which adorned the Acropolis. He was then sent to study with Anaxagoras. Socrates went on to study under the philosopher Archelaus, by whom he was beloved in the worst sense, according to Diogenes Laertius, the 3rd century AD biographer. In ancient Greece, as still in much of the eastern Mediterranean, homosexuality was regarded as a quite acceptable diversion. Not until the advent of Christianity was a limited heterodox approach to replace such orthodox sexual practice. So while Anaxagoras was forced to flee Athens in fear of his life for teaching his pupils that the sun was a radiant star, Archelaus remained free to indulge in more than intellectual intercourse with his pupils. With Archelaus, Socrates studied mathematics and astronomy, as well as the teachings of earlier philosophers. Philosophy had been pursued for just over a century, and was very much the nuclear physics of the age. Indeed, the world of philosophy, which consisted entirely of water, then fire, then points of light, and so on, bore as much relation to the real world as the world of modern nuclear physics bears to our own everyday reality. We scarcely regard our encounters with mesons as the highlight of our daily existence, and one suspects that the ancient Greeks had a similarly blasé attitude toward the latest revelation that their world was in fact a goldfish bowl, a furnace, or a fireworks display. Socrates soon decided that these speculations about the nature of the world were of no possible benefit to humanity. For an ostensibly reasonable thinker, Socrates was curiously anti-scientific. Here he was almost certainly influenced by one of the greatest pre-Socratic philosophers, Parmenides of Elea. During his youth, Socrates is said to have met the aging Parmenides and learned much from him. Parmenides resolved the conflict between those who believed the world was made up of a single substance, such as water or fire, and those, like Anaxagoras, who believed it consisted of a great many substances. He overcame this conflict by the simple method of ignoring it. According to Parmenides, the world as we know it is merely an illusion. It doesn't matter how many things we think it is made of, because it doesn't exist. The only true reality consists of eternal being, which is infinite, unchanging, and indivisible. For this being, there is no past and no future. It subsumes the entire universe and everything that can possibly happen in it. All is one, was Parmenides' basic principle. The ever-changing multiplicity we observe is merely the appearance of this static, all-embracing being. Such an attitude to the world is scarcely favourable to science. Why bother with the workings of the world when they are nothing but an illusion? In these early days, philosophy was considered the study of all knowledge. In Greek, philosopher means lover of wisdom. Mathematics, science, and cosmology did not exist as such. For centuries they were considered part of philosophy. As late as the 17th century, Newton called his masterpiece on gravity and the workings of the universe Philosophicae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, the mathematical principles of natural philosophy. Only through the years did philosophy come to be regarded by many as the study of metaphysical, and thus unanswerable, questions. Whenever philosophy actually found the answers to questions, it ceased to be philosophy and became something else, a separate subject such as mathematics or physics. The most recent example of this is usually considered to be psychiatry, which claimed to answer a number of questions and immediately set up shop as a separate science. In fact, it does not fulfill the philosophic requirements of a science, which demands a set of principles that can be tested by experiment, requirements not fulfilled by the inexactitudes of paranoia, psychoanalytic cures for dementia, and other forms of psychopathic disorder. In Socrates' time, this entire field was, of course, considered part of philosophy, and philosophers were popularly regarded by the citizens of Athens, much as the public today regards psychiatrists. Socrates' attitude toward philosophy was certainly psychological in the original sense of the word. In Greek, psychology means the study of the mind. But he was no scientist. The influence of Parmenides saw to that. Reality was an illusion. This had a negative effect on Socrates and his successor, Plato. During their lifetime, a few significant advances were made in mathematics, but only because this was considered timeless and abstract, and thus thought to be in some way connected with the ultimate reality of being. Fortunately, their successor, Aristotle, had a different attitude toward the world. He became in many ways the founder of science and drew philosophy back toward reality. But the unscientific, indeed anti-scientific, attitude that developed with Socrates was to cast a blight on philosophy for centuries to come. Largely as a result of Socrates' anti-scientific attitude, the few great scientific minds of the ancient Greek world worked outside philosophy. Archimedes, in physics, Hippocrates, in medicine, and to a certain extent Euclid, in geometry, were isolated from philosophy and thus from any developing tradition of knowledge and argument. Ancient Greek scientists knew the Earth went around the Sun, knew it was round, and even calculated its circumference. They observed electricity and were aware that the Earth had a magnetic field. Outside the universal wisdom of philosophy, such factual bits of knowledge were isolated to the status of oddities. We owe a great deal to Socrates for placing philosophy on the sound basis of reason. But the fact that philosophy came of age under the aegis of an anti-scientist must count as one of the great misfortunes of human learning. It is difficult to overemphasize the significance of this missed opportunity. The mental energy expended in the Middle Ages calculating the number of angels who could stand on the head of a pin might instead have been dealing with the atoms first posited by Democritus. Rather than questioning the world, Socrates believed we would be better off questioning ourselves. He adopted the celebrated maxim, "Gnote seton," know thyself. This saying is sometimes erroneously attributed to Socrates. In fact, it may well have been coined by the first philosopher of all, Thales. It is also known to have been inscribed at the Delphic Oracle. Socrates began expounding his philosophy in the Agora, the marketplace of ancient Athens, whose extensive ruins are still visible beneath the Acropolis. Socrates' favorite spot here was the Stoa of Zeus Eleutherius, a shady colonnade lined with stallholders selling wares. The stone foundations of this stoa can still be traced quite plainly. They are truncated at their northern end by the busy Athens-Piraeus metro, and from beyond the nearby wire fence, the calm of the ruins is shattered by the clamoring throng, blaring bouzouki tapes, and bawling stallholders of the Monastiraki flea market. All this cannot be very different from the uproar that must have prevailed in Socrates' day. We have to imagine Socrates conducting his philosophic business amidst the ancient equivalent of haggling jeans merchants, ghetto blasters blaring Zorba the Greek, and the plaintive cries of peanut vendors. Yet in spite of this, someone must have actually heard what he had to say. And the young Socrates must have caused a stir in Athens, for by the time he was 30, the Delphic Oracle pronounced him the wisest of men. Socrates said he found this difficult to believe, disingenuously claiming that, "I know nothing except the fact of my own ignorance." In order to discover whether there was any truth in the oracle's pronouncement, Socrates set about questioning the other wise men of Athens, trying to discover what they knew. Socrates was a past master at exposing cant and erroneous beliefs. He would claim he knew nothing and demand of his adversary precisely what it was that he knew. While his adversary explained, Socrates would prick the bubble of his illusions by asking pointed questions. Not for nothing did Socrates become known as the gadfly of Athens. But his method of questioning was much more profound than it often at first appeared. Socrates would seek to clarify the debate by starting from first principles. This meant defining the basic concepts upon which his adversary's ideas rested, exposing inconsistencies, and particularly pointing out the consequences of such ideas. But Socrates also had a keen eye for human absurdity, and was not above reducing his adversary to a laughing stock. Judging from all accounts, he must have been an infuriating conversational opponent, slippery, brilliant, and devious. And there's no doubt that this smart-aleck aspect of Socrates' character earned him more than a few enemies, as well as gaining him a popular following among the iconoclastic youth of his day. It wasn't long before Socrates had demonstrated to his own satisfaction that the so-called wise men of Athens, in fact, knew nothing, just like him. So he concluded that the Delphic oracle had been right. He was the wisest man, because he knew that he knew nothing. Socrates may have been rational and iconoclastic in his approach, but in certain ways he remained very much a creature of his age. Despite all the banter, Socrates seems to have believed that the Delphic oracle spoke with the voice of the gods. He also firmly believed that the soul is immortal and imperishable, and after death our souls continue to exist in another world. Although most of the time he held little truck with superstitious reverence for the gods and the soap opera of their mythology, he certainly believed there was a god of some sort. The reason he gave for this was that everyone appeared to believe in a god of some sort, a curious reason coming from someone who spent his life trying to disabuse people of erroneous thought processes. But Socrates' philosophy was not all concerned with thought processes and analytical method. It also put forward a number of positive proposals, which means he may well have had to endure a taste of his own critical medicine on occasion. In Plato's dialogue, The Phaedo, the character Socrates puts forward a theory of forms. Many consider this to be Plato's own theory, which he is merely expressing through the mouthpiece of Socrates. But when Plato wrote The Phaedo, all the other characters who appear in this dialogue were still alive. It can thus be assumed that unless Plato wished to spend a lot of his time in the courts, the views put forward by these characters are what they actually believed, and as such they are likely to have discussed them with the actual Socrates. Having based so much of the dialogue on factual sources, it seems unlikely that Plato would then have introduced a fictitious Socrates spouting views he never held. Plato also stresses that Socrates frequently put forward these values. Despite such evidence, the theory of forms is usually attributed to Plato. All this goes to show the difficulty of attributing anything to someone who doesn't write anything down, perhaps one reason why so many of us cleverly adopt this ploy. One thing is certain about the theory of forms: neither Socrates nor Plato was the first to think of it. This feat is generally credited to Pythagoras. As we have seen, Pythagoras's studies of musical harmony led him to believe that the world was ultimately made up of numbers. But Pythagoras's conception of numbers was in many ways closer to our notion of form. According to Pythagoras, these abstractions, number, form, were the ultimate reality. They were the changeless abstract ideas from which the concrete, ever-changing particulars of the world were formed. As is evident, this also echoes Parmenides' idea of the ultimate reality consisting of being, the ultimate entity that gives rise to the bits and pieces of our illusory world. In the Phaedo, Socrates describes the nature of the world of forms, or numbers, or ideas. The Greek word he uses is eidos. This is the generic root of our word idea, and it can variously be translated as form, idea, or figure, where the notion of number and form actually coincide. According to Socrates, the world of forms is not accessible to our senses only to thought. We can think of such ideas as roundness and redness, but we do not perceive them. We only perceive a particular red ball. This is created out of the ideas of redness, roundness, elasticity, and so on. But how is this done? According to Socrates, particular objects receive their qualities by participating in the ideas from which they derive. One way of explaining this is to use the image of a plaster cast being made out of a mold. The abstract forms, or ideas, the mold, give the particular object its shape, size, and other qualities. The world of forms is the only real world and is universal. It is the ultimate world in which all particular things participate. This world of forms has a hierarchy which rises to a peak in such universal ideas as good, beauty, and truth. The qualities of goodness, beauty, and truth that we become aware of in particular objects lead us to contemplate these universal ideas in their abstract realm. This is a mystical attitude toward the world. It echoes the Indian thought from which it may well ultimately have derived, where the world is seen as the illusory veil of Maya, which to the good man is transparent. For Socrates, these universal ideas are seen as superior to the world which first causes us to become aware of them. Fortunately, such a woolly system of thought, which scorns the particularity of the world we inhabit, is not entirely without precision. Number being synonymous with these higher ideas, the study of number becomes a superior pursuit. Thus, mathematics was viewed by the Greeks as an enlightening activity, though only in its pure form. Calculating the sum of the angles of a polygon was quite acceptable. Working out the number of buckets needed to fill a tank of water was definitely infra-D. This would have been practical. That is, it might have proved useful in the grubby world of particulars which we are forced to inhabit. Inevitably, such an attitude viewed science as beyond the pale. This attitude was to persist throughout Western culture, and elements of it are still detectable even today. Socrates grew up in the age of Pericles, when Athens was the strongest and most civilized city-state in the Hellenic world. Its advances influenced the entire course of human development. Besides its more concrete monuments, this era also witnessed the flowering of democracy as well as the consolidation of genuine mathematical and scientific thinking, and with Socrates it marked the coming of age of philosophy. The era of comparative peace that had marked the Periclean age came to an end with the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War in 431 BC. This ruinous struggle between the quasi-democratic naval empire of Athens and Philistine militaristic Sparta continued for more than a quarter of a century. The war and its political repercussions played a continuing and crucial role in Socrates' life. It is worth remembering that what now appears to us as boringly sane and reasonable in his philosophy was conceived against an ever-changing background of bigotry, chicanery, and fear. Socrates' search for personal truth was conducted in an age of changing values and ebbing certainties, whose moral climate we would find all too recognizable. Upon the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War, Socrates was called to service as a hoplite, private, third class, with shield and sword. There are many conflicting accounts of Socrates' life, but one thing everyone seems to agree upon is his appearance. Socrates was one of the ugliest men in Athens. He had spindly bow legs, a paunch, his shoulders and neck were hairy, and he was bald. His pate was said to be knobbly. He was also famous for his broad, snub nose, bulging eyes, and protruding lips. Socrates not only looked like a philosopher, he dressed like one. Winter and summer he invariably wore the same shabby tunic, together with a threadbare half-length cloak, and no matter the weather, he always went about barefoot. According to his colleague, Antiphon the Sophist, a slave made to live in this fashion would have run away. Yet, despite all this, Socrates was apparently a good fighting soldier. Ugly, opinionated intellectuals are not usually popular in the ranks, but Socrates was such an oddball that he evidently intrigued his fellow soldiers. He took part in the siege of Potidaea, in northern Greece, where it can get very cold in winter when the north wind whistles down from the Bulgarian mountains. In winter, the ancient Greek armies became a motley bunch wrapped in all manner of skins, with pieces of felt tied around their feet, a far cry from the lithe, naked youths one sees daintily fighting on Greek vases. Socrates' fellow soldiers would watch in amazement as he turned up on parade in the snow and ice in his bare feet, skimpy shift, and holy cloak. But what particularly intrigued Socrates' fellow conscripts was the sight of him thinking. According to Alcibiades, who served on the Potidaea campaign with Socrates, one day the philosopher awoke early and set about pondering a particularly difficult problem. For hours his companions watched as he stood in contemplative pose on a nearby patch of ground, completely lost to the world. At dinner time, he was still there. By now a number of his compatriots had become so intrigued that they decided to sleep outside their tents, just to see how long Socrates could keep up this performance. In the end, he went on thinking throughout the night until the following dawn. Then he came to, offered a prayer to the coming day, and went about his business as if nothing had happened. This is just one of several stories concerning Socrates' ability to lapse into a deep trance, and it has prompted a number of commentators to suspect that he suffered from a form of catalepsy. With other evidence that speaks of him hearing voices, this might cause us to have suspicions about his sanity. Yet so much else we know about Socrates speaks of extreme common sense and level-headedness. Indeed, his philosophy sometimes appears to be little more than brilliantly applied common sense, spiced with a bit of native ironic cunning. But the man capable of drifting into a trance while all about him were enduring the rigors of military boredom was also capable of great bravery when the occasion arose. According to Alcibiades, Socrates once noticed him lying wounded in the midst of a battle, slung him over his shoulder, and proceeded to carry him through a mass of armed enemy soldiers, thus saving his life. Plato recounts how the young Alcibiades once fell in love with Socrates. This is difficult to imagine, and one can only assume that Alcibiades suffered from defective eyesight, though no mention is made of this. In Alcibiades' words, "When I heard his voice, my heart beat as if I was in a state of religious ecstasy." These sound much like the words of an impressionable youth enraptured by Socrates' wisdom. But no, in a passage much appreciated by classical scholars, and much censored by their masters, Alcibiades goes on to describe how he attempted to seduce Socrates. First, Alcibiades arranged to spend all day alone with Socrates, in the hope that their conversation might at some stage turn to the subjects that a lover usually addresses to his darling when they are on their own together. But Socrates stuck to philosophy. Next, Alcibiades asked Socrates to come with him to the gymnasium so they could train together. In those days, most athletic activities took place in the nude, so Alcibiades must have thought things were looking good when Socrates accepted his invitation. Until one pauses for a moment to imagine how the bald, paunchy, spindle-legged Socrates must have looked stripped to the buff for action in the gym. Apparently undiscouraged by this romantically disillusioning sight, Alcibiades even managed to have a wrestling match with Socrates when there was no one else about. Still nothing happened. Finally, Alcibiades decided to invite Socrates to dinner at his house and get him drunk. He didn't succeed in getting Socrates drunk. No one ever managed this, no matter how much drink he downed. But he kept Socrates up so late that in the end he had to stay for the night. And in Alcibiades' words, according to Plato, "So he finally settled down on the couch he had used at dinner, right next to mine, and there was nobody else in the room but us." Under cover of darkness, Alcibiades crept up beside Socrates and put his arms around him. But Socrates still wasn't willing, and in the end they fell asleep in each other's arms, like brothers. By the mores of the time, Socrates' ability to resist the advances of a good-looking young man like Alcibiades was regarded as almost superhuman restraint. Socrates was no ascetic. Both his appearance and other historical evidence point against this. Yet he hardly lived the good life. He was constantly broke because he refused to work. He insisted upon devoting all his time to his God-given task, demonstrating to the citizens of Athens the profundity of their ignorance. But he appears to have received a minimal legacy from his father, and was well looked after by his influential friends, who often invited him to dinner. Socrates was evidently a highly entertaining guest at dinner parties, was willing to stay up chatting till dawn, and was capable of out-drinking everyone else. These dinner parties were usually all-male affairs, but not homosexual events. Heteri, courtesans, were sometimes introduced, and Socrates seems to have enjoyed his fair share of whatever else was going free besides the food and drink. According to Diogenes Laertius, Socrates spent part of his time conducting informal conversation classes with groups of young students. These were held at the shop of a certain Simon the Cobbler, by the boundary stone of the Agora. At the edge of the Agora you can still see the Horos, inscribed, "I am the boundary stone of the Agora," which stands beside the wall of a small ancient dwelling. Recent excavations by this wall uncovered a large scattering of hobnails and a 5th century BC cup inscribed with the name Simon. Miraculously, what had been discovered was the very shop where Socrates taught. A few years ago, when I was in Athens, I visited this spot. I measured the foundations and found they were only 4 paces square. It must have been quite a crush inside, with Simon hammering away in the background and the occasional customer passing in and out, doubtless passing the odd witty comment. Teaching under such circumstances would have required quick-wittedness and the ability to hold an audience, 2 attributes that philosophers appear to have long since dispensed with. Socrates had the talents of a performer, and whatever else may be said of him, he always put on a good show. He remains the great alternative comedian of philosophy. What exactly did Socrates teach at these lessons? One of his best remembered remarks is, "The unexamined life is not worth living." This is very much the attitude of an intellectual with time on his hands. The Greek city-states were probably the first societies to produce something resembling an intellectual middle class with a degree of independence due to democracy and a degree of leisure due to slavery. The Greeks had time to pursue their thoughts for their own sake and arrive at their own conclusions. Original thought of any kind requires idleness, a fact often overlooked by earnest, industrious mediocrities. Socrates believed that a person's true self was his soul, psyche. Earlier philosophers had said that the soul was the eternal breath of life in us, which sleeps while the body is active but wakes while the body sleeps, a kind of immortal subconscious, not too dissimilar from present-day Jungian doctrine. Socrates saw the soul as being much more like the conscious personality, an entity that could be judged clever or stupid, good or bad, that is, something for which we are morally responsible. He believed we should try to make our soul as good as possible, in order to make it like God. But why? Socrates argued that all people seek happiness. Whether they achieve it or not depends upon the state of their soul. Only good souls achieve happiness. The reason why people are not good is because they are attracted to things that appear to be good, but are not really good at all. If only we knew what was really good, we would always behave properly. Then there would be no conflict, either within ourselves or in society. Perhaps only a philosopher could be so naive as to believe this. It is just possible to argue that we do all share some hazy, unexamined notion of good, but as soon as we begin to examine it, reducing it to practical particulars, we find we disagree, both individually and socially. Is it good to spend your time thinking about philosophy? Is it good to deprive women of the vote? The Greeks lived in small city-states, a situation that promoted consensus. Athens, the most powerful of the ancient Greek city-states, had a free adult male population of 42,000 during this period. The Greeks also firmly believed in moderation. Another celebrated maxim carved in stone at the Delphic Oracle was, "Nothing too much." Socrates' idea of good would seem to be very much a product of his circumstances and his era. The total population of Athens during this period, including women, children, foreigners, and slaves, was probably around 250,000. Whether the disfranchised majority in Athens believed they were unhappy because of the bad state of their souls is a different matter. At the age of 50, Socrates married Xantippe. Chauvinist history paints Xantippe as a shrew, but life with Socrates cannot have been easy. Imagine living with someone who spent his days arguing in the streets and never earned a penny, who came back at all hours after drinking with his friends, still with no money, and like all philosophers, was an object of public ridicule throughout the neighbourhood. In the largest collection of contemporary Athenian jokes which has come down to us, almost a quarter feature a philosopher as the fall guy. Xantippe is credited with being the only person who could get the better of Socrates in an argument. Yet, as is often the case in such stormy relationships, the evidence suggests that Socrates and Xantippe were very close. She had 3 sons by him, none of whom appears to have learnt much from his father. According to all reports, they lived normal lives. Despite Xantippe's nagging and disapproval of her husband's behavior, she appears to have been fully aware that she was married to an exceptional human being. She stood by him unquestioningly in his time of need, and was deeply moved at his death. When Socrates was 65, the Peloponnesian War finally ended in humiliation for Athens. The victorious Spartan leader, Lysander, sailed into Piraeus to supervise the establishment of a government sympathetic to Sparta, and installed the 30 tyrants. There followed a period of terror with summary arrests, trials, and the confiscation of political opponents' property. Many of those who believed in democratic rule fled Athens, but Socrates remained. Surprisingly, despite his indomitable individualism, Socrates was not a democrat. Democracy as a form of government was still in its infancy, and unlike nowadays in its more mature form, was capable of both crass incompetence and excess. In Athens, even the generals had been elected by popular ballot, and this method had proved even less effective than our present method of recruiting them from among army officers. The democrats were blamed by many for the disastrous conduct of the war, which had now reduced Athens to its knees. But Socrates argued against democracy on philosophic grounds, consistent with his ethical theory. He maintained that most people remained unhappy souls, unaware of the true good. As such, they were liable to vote into power leaders who also had a mistaken idea about the good. This, and his view that there was only one ultimate good which could only be discovered through his philosophy, was to lead him into dangerous waters. When Plato later developed these ideas in his utopian Republic, the society he came up with was a nightmare. Like Plato and Socrates, both the Soviets and the Nazis believed that there was only one ultimate good, which could only be discovered through their philosophy. One of the leaders of the 30 tyrants was Critias, a former pupil of Socrates. But Critias soon made it clear that he had put the follies of his youth, such as education, behind him. Not that he had forgotten Socrates, far from it. When Critias issued an edict forbidding the teaching of philosophy on the streets of Athens, he specifically mentioned Socrates. Critias knew only too well how his old teacher was capable of twisting the meaning of words to his own advantage, and he was in no mood for this kind of tomfoolery. The activity pursued by Socrates, no matter whether he called it philosophy or not, was expressly forbidden. Some chose to see Socrates' decision to remain in Athens as evidence of his acquiescence to the rule of the tyrants. But during the state of virtual civil war that followed, Socrates made it plain that he had no wish to take part in politics. He insisted upon remaining a man of principle. Yet in 5th century BC Athens, it was virtually impossible to take no part in politics, unless you were a woman or a slave. The tyrants were well aware of the invidiousness of their position, and were keen to involve as many people as possible in their reign of terror in order to spread their guilt. As a well-known man of principle, Socrates was an obvious candidate. One day, along with four others, he was summoned by the tyrants and ordered to carry out a commission for them. He was to travel to the island of Salamis and arrest Leon, a leading member of the democratic opposition. This arrest was illegal, and Leon would almost certainly have been murdered as soon as he was brought to Athens. Regardless of the consequences, Socrates ignored his illegal orders and simply returned home. This decision would probably have cost Socrates his life, but for a series of unforeseen developments. Critias was killed, and shortly afterward the 30 tyrants were deposed. The tyrants were replaced by democrats, who in turn also had it in for Socrates. But in order to heal the wounds of the civil war, a general amnesty was declared, and Socrates was safe. Or so it appeared. In 399 BC, he was arrested on charges of impiety and corruption of the young. The man behind these charges was a leading democrat named Anytus, who held a long-standing grudge against Socrates. Several years earlier, Anytus's son had become a pupil of Socrates and had soon been persuaded by his teacher that he was better off living the philosophical life than going into the family tanning business. The charges against Socrates were an obvious sham, but they involved the death penalty. This seems a bit excessive. Socrates was certainly unpopular, like any intellectual who argues for unpopular causes on grounds of principle, but the death penalty, for a 70-year-old man? There remains a certain mystery about these charges and the consequent proceedings, and it seems unlikely they will ever be fully explained. I say mystery rather than secret, for it seems pretty obvious that everyone in Athens knew what the affair was really about. Socrates stood trial before the 500 members of the ruling council, each chosen at random from among the free men of Athens. The case against Socrates was brought by Meletus, who was merely a front man for Anytus. Meletus was an unsuccessful, young, tragic poet, with long hair, a thin beard, and a beaky nose. He had a cutting, sarcastic way with words, a suitable adversary for the wily old Socrates. Meletus put the case for the prosecution, ending with a demand for the death penalty. It was now up to the accused to defend himself. Here, Socrates seems to have misjudged the seriousness of the situation, and he began treating the court as if it were taking part in one of his philosophical conversation classes. Some of the council were amused, but many were not. In the end, the vote went against Socrates, 280 to 220 in favor of the death penalty. It was now up to Socrates to put forward a counter-proposal for a lesser sentence. Still, he refused to take the trial seriously. The charges against him were ludicrous, and he knew it. Socrates suggested that instead of being punished, he should in fact be honored for all he had done for the city. Instead of the death penalty, he should be granted a place at the Prytaneum, the sacred hall where Athenian heroes were given free board at the public expense. Uproar in court. Acknowledging this outrage, Socrates demurred. He proposed that instead he should pay a fine, one commensurate with what he could afford. He suggested the derisory sum of 1 mina, enough to buy a pitcher of wine. Further uproar. Socrates' friends were now begging him to come to his senses. Reluctantly, Socrates proposed that instead of the death penalty, he should be fined 30 mina. By now the council had had enough. This time they returned a verdict of 360 to 140 in favor of the death penalty. There is more than a hint of pig-headedness in Socrates' attitude to all this. Did he seriously believe the court would recognize his worth and release him, or was he determined to die? Had he suggested a sentence of exile, the court would certainly have agreed, and Socrates would have been comfortably supported in exile by his friends. It would appear that Socrates harbored a desire for martyrdom, if only subconsciously. Socrates should have been taken from the court and his sentence carried out forthwith, but on the day before the trial, the sacred galley had set out on its annual voyage to the island of Delos, more than 100 miles away across the Aegean. No executions were permitted until its return, so Socrates was manacled and taken to the state prison. The precise outlines of this prison may still be seen 100 yards southwest of the present ruins of the Agora, amidst a patch of uneven waste ground littered with ancient stones and old foundations. The cell and inner bathhouse where Socrates was confined are directly on the right as one enters, and it was here that he received his friends during his last days. On this insignificant piece of earth, 6 paces by 6 paces, occurred the scenes described by Plato in his finest dialogues, masterpieces of ancient Greek literature worthy of comparison to Homer and the tragedies. The hero of these dialogues remains himself throughout, utterly human, wise, and infuriatingly admirable, much as one imagines he intended. At one stage his friend Crito explains that he has hatched a plot for his escape, bribing the guards to turn a blind eye. But Socrates will have none of this. It would be contrary to everything he stands for. Socrates believed steadfastly in the rule of law, even when it was wrong. Finally, news arrives that the sacred galley has been sighted rounding Cape Sunion. It will soon be in Athens. Socrates' friends and his wife, Xantippe, gather in his cell. Socrates then sends Xantippe away because he wants no upsetting displays of emotion. As she leaves, Xantippe protests, "But you're innocent." Characteristically, Socrates replies, Would you rather I was guilty? Socrates discusses with his friends, disciples would be a more apt description at this juncture, the nature of death and immortality. This is rendered in deeply moving detail by Plato, even though he was not there. On this, of all days, Plato was confined to bed with a fever. Then Socrates is handed the bowl containing the hemlock. Athens operated a do-it-yourself execution policy. True to the end, Socrates pleads ignorance, asking, "What is the proper way to do this?" "Just drink it down," replies the servant. "Then walk about until your legs feel weak. After that, lie down and the poison will do the rest." Am I allowed to pour a libation to the gods? No, don't spill any, or there may not be enough for the poison to work properly. Socrates downs the bowl in one draught. His friends are no longer able to disguise their grief and begin weeping uncontrollably. Socrates admonishes them. "Pull yourselves together. Didn't I send Xantippe away to avoid this kind of scene?" He lies down, and slowly the numbness creeps up his body. "Remember, Crito, I owe a cock to Asclepius," are his final words. Then the gadfly of Athens is dead. Socrates' last words, as recorded by Plato, have the ring of authenticity, not least because it is not precisely clear what they mean. Here we can be fairly certain that truth triumphed over literature, even if Plato did have to rely on the hearsay of his friends. Inevitably, Socrates' last words have been subjected to various explanations. The most obvious is that Socrates simply owed a chicken to a friend named Asclepius, and wished to pay off his debt. But this is far too banal for many scholars. Asclepius, besides being a fairly common name, was also the god of medicine and healing. He was usually depicted walking with a staff entwined with a snake, the origin of the emblem that adorns pharmacies and ambulances to this day. Some suggest that Socrates' last words mean that he wanted his doctor's bill paid off. Others have put forward a more ingenious metaphysical explanation. An alternative translation of Socrates' last words reads, "Crito, we ought to sacrifice a cock to Asclepius. See to it, and don't forget." Asclepius's powers were said to include the ability to heal one's soul of the ills of this world in preparation for the next, so Socrates' gift of a chicken may well have been in the hope of a safe passage for his soul to the next world. This would be in line with his belief in the immortality of the soul. As Socrates explained to his gathered friends before he drank the hemlock, only those who have lived an evil life hope that death is the end of everything for them. This is perfectly reasonable, for it is in their interests that it should be so. However, I am convinced that the souls of the wicked wander desolately through the lower world of Tartarus. Only those who have lived good lives will be admitted to the real world. Socrates was man enough and philosopher enough to admit an element of uncertainty on this point. Before drinking the hemlock, he announced to his friends, "We go our separate ways, I to die, and you to live. Which one is better, God alone knows." Within days of Socrates' death, the people of Athens realized the enormity of what they had done. A period of mourning for Socrates was declared. Gymnasia, theatres, and schools were closed. Miletus was condemned to death, and Anytus was banished. Later, a bronze statue of Socrates by Lysippus was erected on the Sacred Way, somewhere for the unemployed to gather beneath their noblest protagonist. This is all very honourable, and would appear to reflect well on the citizens of Athens, but to me it suggests that Socrates was merely a pawn in some deeper political contest. In the overall game, Socrates, as usual, won hands down, or we wouldn't be reading about him today.